All right. Well, hey, good afternoon, everybody. You're listening to the AOHP Caring for Healthcare Professionals podcast in conjunction with the ASSP Health Beat podcast. And this is episode 50, which is really quite a trip. We've gotten 50 episodes in since this time, which was April of 2021. So 3 years, 50 episodes. I'm not sure how that cuts up across the years and the months, but we've done quite a lot of conversations about a lot of topics. So if you haven't seen us in the past, we're on the interweb, so you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any of the other services for that matter. And all 50 episodes are up there. So definitely check that out if you haven't seen it already. And as always, we're very thankful to both AOHP and ASSP for their confidence and trust in letting us do this podcast for these 3 years. And not worrying about us ruining their brand name. So that's always a bonus. If you haven't heard us before, I'm Corey Worden. I've been the professional development person for AOHP National for the last couple of years, and the professional development person for ASSP Health B, I'm sorry, Healthcare Practice Specialty for the last 2 years. Before that, I was the administrator of the Healthcare Practice Specialty for 2 years, and before that, the assistant administrator. So as always, we're very grateful to everybody on all the advisory boards and everybody that's participated in these podcasts, our webinars, or publications for that matter, and conferences. So enough of me, though. We're going to go ahead and get going with today's topic. So we're talking about time management today, which is always going to be relevant because there's so much that goes on in our rarefied profession. You know, whether you're a safety professional or industrial hygienist or occupational health professional or risk manager, anybody that works in our orbit, there's more to be done than there's ever going to be time for. It's just a reality that we've learned to live with. And that's assuming that you don't get a whole array of new tasks, you know, from a leadership or from somebody else, or there's not an emergency that pops up. So dealing with that has always been a interesting conversation because everybody does it a little bit differently. You know, some people have a certain way of scheduling things, some people have a certain way of prioritizing things, and there's always something to it that's interesting to talk about and always something to learn from. So what we're going to do today is kind of talk about that, the different ways to manage time and priorities. And at the same time, we're going to talk about that in the context of how we manage safety. So that will be talking about things like analyzing risks or determining risk controls or training or communication or validating the risk controls with leading indicators or measuring fallout with lagging indicators and all of those things that we've learned over the years. So we're going to get right into that. Before we do, though, we wanted to take a moment so you can hear from our panelists today. So we got a great panel with all kinds of professionals from different areas of the career field slash industries. So, Dr. Hunter, why don't we start with you this time? If you can give us just a quick intro, maybe 30 seconds is about right. You know, who you are, where you're from, what you do, education, current position, whatever you want to share, we appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you for including me today. And I'm from Connecticut, and I work in the insurance industry, and I'm a senior loss control consultant. My background from a standpoint of occupational safety is my undergraduate, master's, and PhDs are all in occupational safety. The latest was safety sciences from Indiana University of Pennsylvania. In my world, I work in the healthcare and social services sector as well as some public entities. And have spent a lot of time, as we all know, this industry needs a lot of help these days. So thank you for having me, and I appreciate being here.
Awesome. Thank you. We're definitely glad to have you on again. If in case anybody hasn't seen or heard, Dr. Hunter has done a lot of great webinars and podcast episodes that are on the channel. So definitely check that out if you haven't already. Dr. Mitchell, why don't we go to you this time?
Hey there. Thanks so much for having me. You've heard my voice on several other podcasts, and I must apologize for my voice. I have a bit of allergies kicking in here in the Houston area. So I do a couple things. I'm an occupational infectious disease epidemiologist and an industrial hygienist by trade. And I think I'm going to bring a little bit something different to this podcast because I work for myself. So I run a nonprofit that is focused on healthcare worker safety and health. And then I also function as a contractor to the federal government. So I think my take on time management is a little bit different as an entrepreneur, and I'm excited to dive into those of you that may be brave enough to follow that kind of high risk, high reward type of career.
Awesome, that's fantastic. Yeah, like she was saying, if you've been hanging out with us for a little bit over the last couple of years, you've definitely probably heard and seen Dr. Mitchell several times on our podcast, including the ones that we're about to post this week, which is a three-hour discussion about HCPCS and the CDC and disease exposure prevention and all kinds of things that are very relevant right now with the HCPCS review going on of the infectious disease prevention protocols. So, a lot of great context there. All right, awesome. Let's go to Ronala Ernest. She's with the ASSP Public Sector Practice Specialty, among other things. Ronald, if you can give us a quick intro, please.
Yes, thank you, Corey. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm so honored to be part of this panel. My name is Ronila Ernest, and my educational background is I have a master's in public health with a focus on industrial hygiene. I have been in the health and safety field for close to 19 years, and over those years, I have worked in both public and private sector. Currently, I am working for myself. I have a consulting company and I contract with the federal government. In the past, I have worked with school districts, with Bureau of Prisons, NASA, all of those federal agencies, too many to name, but just to give you an example. And then also, City of Houston, which was the most recent one where I had the fortune of getting to know Corey and Dr. Guillory. So that's me in a nutshell. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Awesome, thank you. Yeah, definitely glad to have you on. This is Ronald's first venture with us, so that's good. Well, welcome. All right, awesome. Marilee Sartain is on, and she is with the healthcare practice specialty. She's the current administrator there, among other things. Marilee, if you want to give us a quick intro, please.
Sure. Marilee Sartain, and I'll start with my degrees are in secondary science education from FSU and industrial hygiene and safety from University of Houston, Clear Lake. Over my 20 to 25 years of EHS experience, I began in the chemical industry, chemical manufacturing. That's really where I found out about the field of industrial hygiene and safety. Then I perused over to a little bit of government contractor experience at the local Navy base, and then some smaller firms, and have worked in hospital and health cares and community clinics. And similar to Dr. Mitchell, I decided to start my own consulting and training business a few years ago, and it's definitely a whole new perspective with relationship to time management. And added to the mix, most recently, my husband just retired. So it's even added a few more twists and turns into time management. So I'm looking forward to hearing how we all approach the subject and how we are managing things.
Awesome, thank you. Yeah, definitely had good to have you on. All right, cool. And it looks like Dr. Guillory was able to join us. He had to find his way out of a meeting to get here, so we're glad you made it. If you want to give us a quick intro, please.
Only for you, Corey. Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right, so Dr. Stephen Guillory, I am currently a senior staff analyst and safety program manager for the city of Houston. My safety career has been pretty much entirely public sector, so I consider myself an expert in public sector occupational health and safety. As far as education goes, from bachelor's to master's to PhD, it ranges from environmental policy and management to occupational safety to overall safety sciences. My passion, honestly, I would say I know a lot more about environmental policy and management. A few people know that on the call, but calling card is safety because that's the job and that's the opportunities I've been given. Of late, I've been given the opportunity to teach at several universities. So that's new to me. So having to juggle the full-time job from 9 to 5 and then go home to teach grade, have virtual meetings with students, as well as the weekend, has taught me a whole new aspect of time management. So I'm looking forward to hear everyone's feedback as well as give mine. Thank you, Corey.
Awesome. Thank you. Definitely glad to have everybody here. All right. It's also, it's always very cool to me to kind of see how small the world is. You know, I know when I always laugh about it is when I joined the Air Force, which was in 2004. Well, I joined in 2003. Then I went to basic training in 2004. You know, all that I knew was I was trying to, you know, go fight the war on terrorism. And the Air Force kind of put me into the emergency management field, which led to counter-cyber and operations and all of that. And then that I kind of slipped into the city part of it. I didn't even know safety was a career field people did for a living until I was well into the military. So coming out of that and then kind of finding my way into construction and manufacturing and then into the public sector. And then I was able to kind of go over to healthcare, and then I came back to the public sector with kind of a, I kind of live a double life, so to speak, where we do public health / public sector / law enforcement / fire protection and everything else with all the different seaburn hazards. And so we've been able to meet all these people over the years in all these different industries and all these different worlds, which is really very cool because it's a lot of stuff that I didn't even know existed until I was like 25 years old. So I'm always happy to be here. So with that being said, we're going to get into it. First things first. So one of the things that has been really reinforced and reiterated over and over again at all the different conferences for the last decade, at least, is that, quote unquote, you know, safety is not a priority. Safety is a value because priorities change and safety is always a value. And so that's one thing we're always constantly trying to get across. But as we all know, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference to constantly wave banners and slogans and cliches after a while. But instead, being able to actually operationalize these things and make them actionable. So, okay, if we're telling the people that we want safety to be a value, then what does that actually look like in the real world? And so that tells us that we need them to understand, number one, of course, is what risks exist within their work and what are we going to do about those risks? And then how are we going to train people to do that? How are we going to communicate so they don't forget to do it? How are we going to validate so that it's done right and we don't backslide and start doing things with unsafe conditions or unsafe work practices? And then how do we measure any kind of potential fallout so we know if something negative happened and what we're going to do to prevent it from reoccurring? And so the idea is that, number one, we manage all those things, you know, quote unquote, safety management or risk management or emergency management. And then the other thing is we want to get that into a place to where people who have other jobs that they do every day and they're not, safety is not in their job title, so to speak, but they can still live these things so that they're participating and engaging and playing a integral role in it. So to do all that, there is much more to be done than there are hours in the week. It's just a reality. So we have to juggle those things, and we don't want to let one thing slip because then the system doesn't doesn't work as intended. You know, for example, if we don't identify and assess the risk, then we can't control the risk because we don't know it exists, or we understand it wrong. If we don't train people, they won't know how to use the equipment or the procedures or the PPE. If we don't communicate it, they may forget about it. If we don't validate it, we won't know if it's not working. So any part of that can create a negative outcome. And so that kind of brings us here, is that what we're going to talk about is the different ways to manage all of that and keep things progressing in a positive way. So first things first, one of the other things we know about safety is that if we try to do it all ourselves, we're invariably going to miss something. You know, I always say this, especially with healthcare, is any given healthcare environment, like a hospital, for example, you've got all of these different departments in the hospital. You know, you've got inpatient care, you've got surgery, you've got pharmacy, you got lab, you got the emergency department. And so for me to talk like I know everything about all those different departments would be inherently wrong. It just would be foolish, because obviously there's people that have dedicated their entire life to learning to be a nurse or a physician or a pharmacist or a lab manager or whatever they're doing. So we have to get that subject matter expertise so that we can better run this safety management system. So that's the first thing there. We got to set up these different committees or these different groups. We got to make the agenda. We got to make the minutes. We got to make sure there's open action items. We got to close the action items. So that in itself is a heck of a thing to do. So let's start on that. How do we gather subject matter expertise, and how do we learn from that subject matter expertise? How about Dr. Hunter, let's start with you to kick that off. How do you go about gathering that, all those different perspectives and expertise?
I would say, from my perspective, and so I'm working with a diverse group of, the world would think of them as clients, but in my organization, they're members and there are insurers. And one of the things is that, and this is something that I always think people don't always understand, depending on what type of organization is, it could be a different person in the organization. And so, for instance, you mentioned a hospital, Corey, and in a hospital, we would go department by department to identify who's the right person to work with. In some organizations, depending where the risk is, I might be working with the facilities team. And in others, if I'm working, I do a lot of healthcare with home healthcare. So in those cases, maybe we need to look at the line employees, and are they the ones that can give us the best information? So what I would say from that perspective is I look at each organization, and one of the first things I have to understand is how it operates and who are the people that can look at those risks and help me identify so that we can understand where we can help them best.
Definitely a lot of people involved there. Dr. Gilroy, let's go to you this time. What are your thoughts about that? And another way to think about this, as everybody's kind of listening to the different feedback, is what I always say is, I always assume that people that don't have safety in their job title, they're probably willing to commit, if they're motivated and they really want to engage, they're probably willing to safely commit about like 2-5% of their week and say, okay, I can do something for you. So the question now is, of course, do you want me to go to a safety committee meeting? Do you want me to do an inspection? Do you want me to do an observation? Do you want me to fill out a report? But being that they don't do this professionally, you know, they're not able to commit 50 or 70% of the week to us. So kind of think in that context is, if we're asking people to commit a certain percent of their week, what do we want them to do with that week? So if we're trying to seek out subject matter expertise, how do we find those people and how do we optimize their time as well as ours? That's kind of a way to go about it. So what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Gilroy?
So Corey, do me a favor and clarify, because I don't want to answer out of line. I caught the second part, but I'm trying to tie it into the first, your initial question.
Yeah, we were just talking about how to, gather different perspectives on the different risks and the different subject matter expertise from the different people in the organization. So how do we fit that into our schedule, and how do we do that in a way that optimizes both our time as well as the other people that aren't safety professionals?
Gotcha. So first and foremost, you really need to know your organization if you're talking about an organization or your customer if you are talking about doing consultation work, right? Knowing what they bring to the table, knowing their skill set, knowing their passion. I would say passion is probably the most important. You and I both know, and Ronald also can attest to this at the City of Houston. We have many individuals that aren't safety titled, they are not in a safety department or division, but they just have a passion for safety, right? And they tend to do their own research and they pretty much know the answers and know how to get things done. So it's just a matter of identifying those people. That's the first part of it. Now, when it comes to time management and how much to expect from that person, it's really not our job to make that expectation. But again, those that are passionate about safety, those that are knowledgeable about safety, are those that have a role in safety but don't have the title. All that stuff kind of factors into how much time they can give, right? So when I go in personally, I don't make expectations on anyone in regards to time. If they could give 1 minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I'll take it because those individuals that I'm speaking of, that 10 minutes is probably worth 60 minutes compared to someone that doesn't have the passion, if that makes sense. So that's how I go about it, Corey. But first, you have to know the people that you're working with, other people that you're working for, and what they can bring to the table, and vice versa. From the safety side, our job is 100% safety. It all depends on what part of safety, whether it's environmental, industrial hygiene, ergonomics, data. Like right now, I'm working on a lot of data and statistical analysis, right? That may not be a safety function per se, but it is a safety function in my case because it's going into well, it's looking at data from our safety management system, for example. So, yeah, that's kind of hard to answer, Corey, from a time standpoint. But the one thing I will say from the safety manager, the safety leader, the safety professional standpoint, you do have to be cognizant of others' time. We can't make expectations, hey, I need this done by next week, right? Because you don't know what that person has on their plate for their actual job. So again, I let those that I'm working with determine what they can and can't do. And from there, I make that decision to stick with this person or even say, hey, you know what? I'll use Marina for an example. She's one of our safety superstars. You know what, Marina? Don't worry about it. I'll go somewhere else or I'll even do it myself because you got something else that you need to deal with. So it's, I know I'm kind of going around the circle without hitting the middle cord, but that's my take on it. No expectations from me. Anything that I can get, anything that we can get, we'll take it, especially if it's quality.
Cool. Yeah, it's definitely a it's always difficult to ascertain what other people have going on, to your point. So, if we're if we're pushing too hard, there's a chance that could just as easily backfire, and then you lose that person's perspective or engagement. Definitely. All right. Dr. Mitchell, why don't we go to you this time? What are your thoughts about that as far as gathering input, gathering insight, and how to fit that into your schedule as well as the people that you're working with?
Oh boy. It was very different across different organizations that I've worked for. So I worked for the federal government. So I started my career at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which was very, very, very different on the way to take stakeholder impact in, because it was mostly based on public comments from Federal Register notices and daily calls. Back then, email didn't exist. So daily calls from employers that really needed help on compliance with standards. And then when I did occupational health and safety for corporate America, mostly in the medical device field, it was difficult because you had to balance internal employee health and safety with user health and safety, meaning did the device work? It wasn't going to injure anybody. It worked as it was supposed to work. And then when I went into academia, which was more research, it was doing research based on what funders wanted. And now as a contractor and actually running my own nonprofit, as a contractor, you really need to listen to the needs of the corporation or the organization or the federal government that you're working for and really help them navigate through messages. And Corey, I've said this so many times, actually in every podcast that we've done, is that we're really good as occupational health and safety practitioners in knowing the technical stuff, how to test for things, how to run machinery, lockout, tagout, personal protective equipment, air monitoring. All of those things we're really good at technically, but we really are terrible at communicating messages. So I think one thing that I've always said in my career is that it's so important to translate the importance of technical information into public health information or into occupational health information. So really not just tailoring the team that you have, but tailoring the messages, who they're directed to, and what is going to reach them. So, you know, if you put up big posters in a healthcare facility, let's say, about the importance of dry floors for not slip, you know, for no slips, trips, and falls, that's not really going to resonate with somebody who might be more worried about central sterile supply and exposures to glutaraldehyde and ethylene oxide, you know. So you really do need to tailor the message to the audience based on what's happening in your facility. So using your surveillance data from your OSHA 300, from whatever surveillance system you use, to tailor the message to the audience rather than just creating broad safety messages. And that's ultimately what I think I've learned over the years, is the more targeted the message, the more targeted the intervention to your audience, the more success you'll have.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it reminds me of a conversation we've had recently about there was a somebody, their intention was that they wanted to have a standardized PPE matrix. And what my feedback or input to that was, I said, I understand that we do want to make things efficient and effective, so standardization is good. I said, but if you're making the same PPE matrix for somebody that's working in an industrial wastewater plant versus somebody that's working in a public health clinic, it's not going to be aligned. You know, for example, just the visual of it. If you imagine somebody, they're wearing safety toe boots and, you know, level D protection and a hard hat, you know, possibly, you know, have sewage on their person, you know, and then you compare that to somebody that's wearing a scrubs and an isolation gown and an N95 respirator, you know, obviously it would not be the same PPE matrix. So to your point, yeah, definitely being able to get those perspectives and being able to specify that is always going to be important. A great point. Merit Lee, let's go to you this time. What are your thoughts about it as far as taking time and within your work schedule to locate subject matter experts and get different perspectives and feedback, and how to also optimize that time for them as well so that they're not overtaxed or overburdened?
It's really interesting because as I'm hearing y'all talk, I'm thinking back to a recent client visit I had. and the importance and the value of me spending time with the workers who are doing the job. Because management has one perspective, and I totally appreciated that management took almost a full day to walk around with me and review lockout tagout procedures. And we actually got to witness someone doing it while we walked around. And that was so valuable. And yet part of the challenge was understanding expectations from everybody involved. So to your point, you know, Dr. Mitchell talked about, you know, clarifying what the client's expectation is, right? And then making sure that the time that you spend with the employees and with leadership to accomplish tasking, sometimes it is time that you didn't expect that it would take as much time as it did. I am absolutely guilty of, you know, I'll laugh and say my husband actually says, yep, you're right on target, Mary Lee. It took you twice as long as you said. So I kind of laugh. So if it was a 10-minute task and it took 20 minutes, you know. And so sometimes in a work environment, there are other things that, you know, come into play, right? What jumped in? And part of the question that we were looking at some of what we were going to talk about today, how do you handle those things that come up? And I can't even tell you how valuable it was for me to spend 20 minutes with an employee that was almost ready to leave for the day on that Friday afternoon, but he took the time to actually do that demonstration of applying the tag, applying the lock, doing that lock, tag, try, verify. And as I then asked him questions of certain things, it became apparent that he was doing some very risky behaviors that had not even been thought about in the job that he was performing. And so that's now going to lead into, you know, procedures getting revised. And it's something that, did leadership know this was going on? Had they witnessed that? Had they reviewed the procedures? And it's a young, a client that is young in their safety journey. You know, they are just starting to get things in writing and training being had and formalizing their safety management system and implementing that learning management system and ensuring, you know, you hit so many things I heard you say earlier related to, you know, there's that whole project management and systematic process of what we go through and ensuring that once we develop it, then we implement it, then we have to do the continuous improvement process and always verify and validate, is it working? That whole PDCA process, right? Are we making those corrections and changes as they're needed? And I think that's something that is time consuming, especially in an organization that is new and young in their safety program development and implementation, as opposed to larger organizations. When I started my career at a huge corporate chemical company, there was lots of resources, lots of, you know, subject matter experts that had already developed things, were improving and improving and improving, and they were already so much further into that continuous improvement process. And so time management was something that was just honed in on and done very well, and to the point that everyone in the organization had to learn some time management skills of facilitated meetings to ensure that you had designated people to address the tasking in the meetings and follow up to make sure things got done and making meetings shorter and more efficient and more effective. So I know I kind of shared a few different things there, but I feel like those are some of the items that we wanted to talk about today. And how, you know, I like the way Dr. Mitchell talked about it. You know, our world has changed from before we had the internet and resources at our fingertips to even now, all the way through to AI coming into play. Things are exponentially changing, as always. And the information age. I can even remember early on in my career, that was part of the paradigm of, you know, the information age is coming and we got to be prepared for it. And that was being talked about 30 years ago. And here we are today. And how are we managing it? What is that doing to all of our people that have so many expectations put on them? And recognizing that we still have to factor in the human being. So that's where I'll end that comment and let you pick up.
That's definitely true. You know, that's one thing. For sake of time today, we won't go down that road because that's a whole different conversation with AI. I always joke about that. I say, you know, I saw Terminator 2 in 1991 in the seventh grade, and I've known since then that AI scares me. So now the fact that it's everywhere and it's being promulgated and proliferated, it scares me more. So there's something to be said about that and its relationship to safety, but that would definitely be a conversation for a different time. And it's also definitely interesting is that, you know, to everybody's point, you know, if we're able to find the people that have the knowledge, skills, and abilities, and then make that message and make that education more specific and more aligned and targeted, then we can get the information back from them, you know, to complete the communication loop much more efficiently so that it doesn't take as much of their time and therefore much of our time. Another thing that's interesting about this, you know, we can talk about this another time as well, is if you're talking about just the risk management strategies, is if we're trying to get somebody else's subject matter expertise, whether it's, again, knowledge, skills, and or abilities, there's always the possibility for risk transfer. So we can just, not completely, but to a degree, take ourselves out of it, and they can handle it, and the same thing gets done with a different measurement of safety without us having to take the time to do the messaging and the training and the communication over ourselves. So it's an interesting thing with all those different resources. So Ronald, I was going to ask your opinion about this, and then after this, we'll talk about some of the other things, such as the more operational stuff like risk control and training. But first, Ronald, what are your thoughts about this as far as subject matter expertise, gathering perspectives, and how to do that in a way where the time is optimal for us as well as for the people we're working with?
Thank you, Corey. So first step would be data gathering, is trying to find out what the organizational priorities are or the client priorities are, speaking to the employees to find out what the immediate concerns are, what their priorities are, and kind of aligning them with what the safety goals are. Analyzing that data, and I have found in the past that if you have something like a matrix, for example, risk assessment matrix or an Eisenhower matrix, and you plot it against the X and Y axis as, you know, urgent or not urgent, important, not important, and categorize the tasks in such a way where there is clarity across the entire team that you have, is what to do first, what we can schedule for later, what can be delegated, and what really can be eliminated, which is not urgent and not important at this time. With the understanding that it's flexible and it will need to be reviewed and adapted continuously. So, and then that presenting that data and being very transparent about why you came up with this matrix and the ranking system, so to speak, of keeping the focus mainly on prevention and minimizing the reactive measures. So those are, you know, the strategic way of really, and the intentional way of tackling the issues, and communicating, like it has been mentioned before, communication is the key, and that would eliminate a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, what the priority is, why we are doing XYZ, and also while you're communicating, give opportunity for feedback so that you can keep refining your plans. So that's really been the way that I've tackled it. A bit the risk assessment, assigning codes also has been very helpful to me in the past, because in several different organizations, I have noticed that people just get overwhelmed with the amount of stuff that needs to be done, amount of safety goals and where they would like to be versus where they are currently. So once we can prioritize and they can focus on one step, one task at a time, it is doable. I have noticed that the compliance goes up and the people who are really able to only devote 5% of their task, they know exactly what tasks to focus on to get the maximum reward or return for it. So that's usually the way I would approach it. Thank you, Corey.
Awesome. Yeah, it's definitely, that's one of the truisms that we're working with, is there's only a finite amount of time. And even with some of our partners, that time is even less because they're not spending 100% of their week on safety or related functions. So those are all great inputs. And what that does is it kind of sets us up so that we have the right people involved, they have the right message and the right objectives, initiatives, and then we're able to get to work as far as what needs to be done to actually do the work safely, or at least reasonably safe. It's interesting. This is one of the things that I always talk about. If anybody heard, we did the conversations about a year and a half ago, maybe a year ago, with Norman Ritchie and Sean Galloway, where we were talking about the high reliability principles. And that's one of the things that both of them mentioned several times, was that, you know, it is possible to make things too safe. If we make something so safe that nothing else gets done, then it's actually counterproductive. You know, like the example I always use is when we're doing public health testing, you know, it's possible to make it so safe by keeping everybody in quarantine. You know, nobody's going to get sick, but we're also not going to do any public health testing. So it's an interesting predicament, is we want to make things reasonably safe without crippling the operation itself. So this brings us into risk control. So we'll get talked about this a little bit. I think this, judging from this conversation, we're going to have a lot to say, so we may need to go to a part two if y'all are up for that. But for now, let's talk about risk control for a moment. Let's see, Marilee, why don't we start with you this time? What are your thoughts about this as far as time it takes for selecting equipment or recommending equipment, procedure, writing procedures, selecting and inventorying PPE or installing equipment, things like interlocks and stuff like that, or training, teaching people how to do things like PPE donning and doffing, or respiratory protection, fit testing, all of those different things. It's an endless list. So how do you go about taking the information from those subject matter experts and then turning that into operational risk controls? And how do you do that without it taking up all your time? What are your thoughts on that, please?
Well, that's an interesting one for me, because that the things that we went through during the pandemic, right? There was a lot of time spent on getting, you know, unfortunately reacting, in my case, having been at a community health center and having to react to what was going on. And we had done a great job at, to Ranilla's point, we'd done a great job at that hazard risk matrix for pretty much every other hazard: hurricanes, flooding, severe weather, the common ones we have all the time here on the Gulf Coast. But the pandemic had just kind of fallen to lower on the priority list, and then here it was. And so, to your point with the question, Corey, the risk controls that had to be put in place, trying to ensure that we had enough PPE, that we didn't run out? Did we have to reuse? Unfortunately, in some cases, we had to extend the life of the use of some of the respirators because we didn't have enough inventory at the time. And that required additional training and development. And that took more time than expected. And so I guess that kind of leads into some of those things with those hierarchy of controls and having the layers of controls in place. Because could we do everything perfectly at every site location? No. But at the locations where we knew we had a higher probability for risk of spread, we did implement more things. So as far as timing for the risk controls that you put in place, ultimately, I love the way, you know, I think it was Dr. Mitchell that commented on, we want to take that proactive approach, right? And ultimately, I think of training as that largest piece of a proactive approach, because if we can help educate and train people on the hazards and help them learn how to make good choices to handle their risk or their level of risk acceptance, can that influence the entire organization and ensure that we have the effective, you know, like I said, layers of controls in place, right? There's a multitude of things that have to happen. We have to have written procedures. We have to do that medical approval before fit testing. We have to take those steps. And all of those things take time. And that's what we're talking about, right? How realistic is it to take the time that you need? And again, I love you hit that point, right? You can't make it too safe, so to speak. I remember early on in my career, I used to think, okay, we got to do it this way. And you know, all the way to that top highest quality degree of control. And yet reality is, if you know, it's that magic triangle, right? You can't have high quality, have it fast, and cheap. One of those has to be the driver. And so that has to be something that's agreed upon by leadership, right? And oftentimes in my personal career early on, I was at the luxury of working for larger corporations where leadership understood safety and health and environmental. And yet in the last 10 years of my career, I've had leadership that didn't have a clue. And it was part of my job to help educate them. And honestly, that wasn't something I felt like I did effectively enough. And so it's one of those things that as safety and health and environmental professionals, we have to look at that practical approach you talked about. And I have really, in this most recent case where I have this young organization, small business that is implementing things now and is early on in their safety management process and system, it is those big things. And it was something and reassuring to the plant manager that I said, I do get it. We can only eat a toe of the elephant at the time. So let's make sure we agree on what those toes are so that we get those done. So I'll leave it there and let you go to another person to answer that.
Definitely. Yeah, the risk-based decision-making is important. That's actually something we've been talking about on the HICPAC conversations is that, you know, when people talk about disease exposure prevention, a lot of times they jump straight to PPE. You know, they go, oh my goodness, everybody needs all this PPE. And then, of course, the next discussion point is we don't have that much PPE and we don't have time to train all those people. So then they go, okay, well, let's lower the bar and just use surgical masks. And so it's like we're trying to cover all these masses of people, which is impossible. And so then they go, well, the only logical solution is to lower the bar and not protect anybody, you know, and it just becomes such an issue. But instead, to your point, you know, if we do risk-based, there are people that can be on quarantine or telecommuting. There are people that can be physically separated with good indoor ventilation and filtration. There's people that can do distancing and source control and hand hygiene. And then for the people that have to be in 6 feet of people that are potentially infectious, then you got the high quality PPE with the respiratory protection, the fit testing. So it is a good way to manage that. Instead of trying to do everything badly, you can do a little bit of it very well, you know, and then implement the higher level controls for the people you can do that. So that's a great point. Dr. Mitchell, let's go to you this time. What are your thoughts about the risk controls and the operationalization?
I knew you were going to come to me next. And, you know, so many Marilee's comments, they just resonate so much. And I'll tell you, it gets really challenging as a contractor or as a consultant. So I've had many federal contracts. I've had many private sector contracts. And so you need to walk this delicate balance between offering your occupational health and safety expertise into whatever it is their culture of or climate of safety is, and then hoping, crossing your fingers, your toes, your hair, your ears, hoping that they take action, and then walking away because the job is done. So this, I think, is one of the challenges. Again, I apologize for my voice. These Houston allergies have got me. Is really in, you know, we did a webinar a couple of years ago now when I was with the National Institutes for Environment Health and Health Sciences, is the ethics of occupational health and safety. So you put your heart on the line, basically, all of us as occupational and health and safety practitioners put our heart on the line every day. We're here to protect the working public. And I would argue that the working public is the largest sector of public health, period. The largest number of people work. And when you are hired as a consultant or as a contractor, you put your heart and soul into it, hoping that the organization takes that and runs with it. And it's almost like being a physician where, you know, somebody comes in and they're suffering with exacerbated breathing and high blood pressure, and you tell them that it's really important to get fresh air and sunshine and walk a little bit and maybe cut back on sweets, and then you just hope that they do it. So I think in a similar way, we're in that position. But to the too safe tone, I also have done several contracts for federal agencies where they've hired me to write safety programs to post online, and I've put my heart and soul into it, and they never did. So I'd just hazard those, and I'm so glad that you have so many of us entrepreneurs on the podcast. I'd hazard those that are thinking about going into business for themselves with the balance you have to walk between putting your heart and soul into what you know is the safest and then hoping they take you up on it. So it, you know, kind of keeps us awake at night, which is a totally different perspective. Actually, you know what? It's the same exact thing doing safety and health no matter what. Last point I'll make. When I was leaving OSHA, I had considered a job with the Office of the Architect of the Capitol. So Washington, D.C. is my hometown. And as I was thinking about it, I thought, these are historic buildings. They're beautiful. They have underground tunnels. They have all of these aesthetics that people really want historically. That is the awe factor of Washington, D.C. How on earth am I going to be their occupational health and safety person thinking about how the walls are going to be bound, no residue on the floor so people don't slip, trip, and fall? So depending on the job that you want to take, you're either set up for failure, like that job, I thought, or set up for success. And so you really need to just determine your own risk profile what are you willing to give that people will accept versus what are you willing to give that you know they're not going to accept? And I think that's a big part of the heart of who we are.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great point. It's interesting. There's times I've seen where time management can be either a crutch, where I've seen people over the years where they'll say, well, there's not enough time to do all this, so I'm going to lower the bar and, you know, not do much of it at all. Or they'll put themselves into burnout and anxiety trying to do 10 people's jobs by themselves. So to your point, once again, you know, if you're able to assess the risk and therefore prioritize out, that gives you at least a better starting point rather than trying to, you know, win the war by yourself or just forfeit the war without even trying. There's definitely a lot to be said about that. So like I was saying, I know we actually have a lot of such great feedback that we're running long today. So just to kind of manage expectations, we'll finish this particular round. So we'll talk about, we talked about the subject matter experts and the gathering input and feedback, and then being able to translate that into the risk controls. So the other half of the conversation is, you know, the communication, the validation, and the measurements and metrics. So if y'all are willing and able, we'll schedule a part two later so we can have a little time to talk about that comfortably. So we'll finish this round and then we'll call it for today. So I can respect y'all's time. So for this topic, we're still talking about the risk controls and how to get those things implemented. So Dr. Gurley, let's go to you this time. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, again, Corey, repeat it for me because I got a lot of noise in my area.
Oh, no worries. We were talking about the different risk controls. So, you know, at this point in the game, if we've managed our time to get with all the different subject matter experts and get all their input and feedback, and now we're able to translate that into implementing risk controls. So whether it's equipment, procedures, PPE, training, all those things that actually make it work in the real world, how do we go about addressing that in a way that's, you know, effective within our schedule?
Oh, great. So again, it falls back to the structure of your organization. For instance, in my former life, I was a manager with employees that actually reported to me. So it was very easy to, you know, delegate certain tasks in that regard. But for those that don't have that authority, like right now, I'm more of a program manager. You have to, I'm not going to say beg, but you have to, again, know who can help in controlling, putting in a place what you have, for example. It's difficult when you don't have a staff to delegate that to, so you have to be very creative. You may have to think outside of the box more often than not, and I find myself doing that a whole lot because at the end of the day, the powers that be don't want to hear that you couldn't get this done because you don't have someone that works for you, right? So you just have to work with people. A lot of the times, you know, looking at your schedule, Corey, most of the tasks can be done. I can do them myself. You could do them yourself, right? But then there are just some tasks that you just can't do because it may be related to another department, another entity, for example, that you don't have any control over. So you just have to be able to have that conversation with the that person in that department or entity, in our case, department, that controls that, and ask them for support, right? And work with that person in getting that done. But in my case, again, I'm using myself as an example. I do what I can do in the light of the time that I have. But for those things that I just know I can't do without support, those are the tasks that I'm happy to give to someone else in hopes that they get it done. And, you know, lucky for me, I've been with the city of Houston 18 years. I know who's capable of what in the different areas. So if I ask for something or if I need something, I'll get it and I don't have to go behind that person and redo it because that's not effective at all or efficient. So I've been blessed in that regard. But if you were to ask me this and I only had like 2 or 3 years of experience in the city, that'd be a difficult question to answer because in my mind, I'm trying to prove myself, not only to myself, but to my peers. And I'm trying to get everything done, not knowing that some things just aren't going to get done by myself. You're going to need some help, and you need to be able to accept that. Help is great, and it's not a detriment to you, your skills as a safety person or a professional.
Cool. Yeah, it's definitely the teamwork goes a long way, definitely. And then again, you know, risk transfer is always in there. That's one of the conversations we always have is if anything comes up with high voltage electricity, you know, we know about it. We know about electricity. We know about lockout, tagout. We know about arc flash. But we also have people that we can transfer the risk to that do that every day. And so, again, if, you know, if we're trying to address that, it's going to be a matter of time. It's going to be a matter of energy and possibly a higher risk. Yeah, definitely a valid point is, you know, having the right people on speed dial is a good thing at times. Awesome. All right. Dr. Hunter, let's go to you. What are your thoughts about risk controls and making these things work in the real world without going crazy?
I'm going to agree with everybody ahead of me and say, I'm going to add a little different slant though, because I think that's what we're looking for is to look at all the different facets of this. So a lot of the organizations that I work with are social service organizations or smaller organizations that truly have no in-house safety expertise. So when you talk about looking at the risk control and operational controls, one of the things that my colleagues and I have to do is help them prioritize. So what's really the most important? And that can be, you know, that can be a challenge because some of them will be based on OSHA standards and regulations. And others might be loss source based, everyday things, everything from slips and fall to materials handling that aren't going to necessarily get them an OSHA fine, but it's where we see the injuries. So I think one of the things that, and I work with a lot of organizations, large organizations, by the way, that may work with adults or children with developmental disabilities, and it's a challenging environment. I was giving a training just yesterday, and I said to my group, I said, you know, if we go into manufacturing and we have an area that is dangerous and it's a machine, we can guard the parts of the machine. I can't put a guard on your people. So one of the things that we tend to look at from the organizational perspective is how do we help them prioritize? And I like the term practical safety because in a social services organization, there are also constraints with all types of organizations, but they may have budget constraints. So how do we help them prioritize what's going to keep their employees safe and ultimately the individuals they work with? And I also like what was said before when we talk about not giving them too big a list or too many things to do at once. So I think our role, and I think Dr. Mitchell said it too, you know, how we can sleep at night is to try to help them prioritize the things that are going to be the most important from a severity and a day-to-day safety perspective of injuries. And I think the number one thing that we're always doing when you pull back in the time piece of it is how can I help them move their safety program along in a time frame and using their time in the best way. So maybe it's a working meeting with them where we literally plan a meeting to accomplish putting a program together. And that's, I think, where I look at it. And wherever I'm meeting with a client, I try to make the meeting as meaningful as possible, because everyone's time is so very valuable. So I think those are my points for you.
That's great. It actually brings to mind a thought I always have as far as in the past, what I kick myself for this now is I have these resources. For example, I have here's a blank matrix for making a risk analysis. You know, and then here's a blank matrix for determining hazard controls. And here's a blank matrix, you know, for developing your communication strategy. And I would teach each of the different hospitals. I at the time I had 14 hospitals. So I would teach each of them how to do this, how to determine risks and how to determine risk controls. And then, of course, you know, their time management is different than mine. They have different things to do. And so I realized over the years that there's a lot of that I can do for them that'll set them up for success that may be lowly prioritized by them. So I can kind of, like, I'm not good at sports analogies, but I'll try. So, like, I can carry the ball up to the 90-yard line, you know, and that way they only have to take it over the end zone. Instead of me handing them the ball on the 50-yard line, they have to run it 50 yards into the end, you know. So that's a great point that you make, is if you've got people that are not safety professionals, they don't have safety professionals, but you're still trying to get them to a level to where you have things that are, you know, reasonably safe, then it's a good way to go about that. That's fantastic feedback. All right, so for today, Ronala, let's see, what are your thoughts as far as risk control and operationalization?
Thank you, Corey. I think mainly going to just echo what everybody said, because most of the points have already been made. What I would like to focus on is, once you have like the risk matrix and you have the priority and identified the high risk areas, then you can, you know, use that and extrapolate to risk control as well. So depending on, for instance, the regulatory requirements and the existing safety culture of the organization. So if it's a proactive culture, you might have, you know, the leading indicators, and if it's reactive, might need to address safety concerns immediately. So you got to jump on those immediately. Similarly, with the maturity of the safety management system. So if you in an organization have a safety management system that has been existing, it's robust, there is committees already existing and training programs being done, that is a more time can be spent on leading indicators and incidence analysis. However, if it's a new system, then it's going to be more time spent on infrastructure building, committees, and training programs. So it's a very different approach that way. I like your sports analogy. I understood completely what you were saying, and that's been my experience as well, as is, you know, giving all of the information, because you being the safety professional, I think that you have more time to devote. Also, you're more educated, have more experience, and are not distracted by other things. So your primary goal is safety. So I have found in the past that if you can give them, say, for example, the 90% that, Corey, you were talking about, there's a lot more success in that. Also, like Dr. Hunter mentioned about available resources, what the staffing level is, what the budget is, you know, if employees have access to technology. And so those are all the things that would factor into risk control. So those were the points that have not been covered, Corey, and I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Yeah, everybody's definitely got a fantastic wealth of knowledge and experience. So it's really a privilege to hear from everybody. All right, well, I'll tell you what, we are actually quite over time, and that's a good thing. There's so much to talk about. and we definitely appreciate y'all's willingness to be here. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go ahead and call it now, and then I'll reach out to everybody, and we'll see if we can schedule a part two and talk about the rest of it, as you know, I don't know. Everybody's thoughts, of course, we'll talk about it later, but you know, I always look at the leading indicator part as such an important part of the safety management system. So we definitely would like to have more time to comfortably talk about that, rather than, you know, impairing your schedule for the day. Before we knock it off though, is there any last comments or, anything anybody wants to bring up before we call it today?
No, I have one thought. Go ahead, Marilee.
Okay, I just had one thought I wanted to add related to, and I think, you know, Dr. Mitchell, you and I both have this different perspective from an entrepreneurial standpoint in a small business. Going to help clients, even though it might not have been on the top two or three priorities to get done, sometimes the low-hanging fruit is a quick win, and that really gets good safety buy-in from all levels of the organization. So, for instance, I'll give just a quick example, and it does relate to training that we'll be covering the next time, but I did some heat stress training, and I was able to use an OSHA grant, Susan Hayward grant for this company, so it didn't cost them my time. The grant paid me my time to help with the training and do the training with our Spanish instructor. And for at least half of the working employees that we did this heat stress training for, they had never had heat stress training before. And so I knew there was going to be value to it, but I didn't realize some of the benefits or extras or synergies that happened until it happened, where, as you know, I'm a big show and tell person. As I do training, I have a lot of training aids and visuals and engaging things. And when I had my cooling vest and my high vis vest, and we were talking about, you know, PPE and its effect on heating and heat stress and all of that, immediately during part of the conversation, as we came to the end of the training, one of the employees said, "Well, we would all benefit by having high vis, not even necessarily cooling vest, but having high vis. And this is a warehousing kind of a situation." And so when that employee piped up and said that, the person that was there in a leadership role said, "You know what? We're absolutely going to get those for you guys." And it was like, when it came from the employee about this suggestion and leadership heard it, they knew right away, yes, we need to be doing that. And so that was kind of a benefit that happened, that although that might have been not the priority like lockout, tagout, it could very well cause a fatality because of heat illness and their situation. And so other things came up at that same time. So I just wanted to share that quick example that, you know, it's a different scenario when you're talking about an organization young in their developing safety plans and programs than a larger organization where we already have a lot of the larger controls in place. So that was my last little ending thought there.